Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what is being described as a coup in Egypt by the Egyptian Supreme Court, who on the eve of the final round of the presidential elections have dissolved the recently elected parliament. Khaled El-Gindi, a visiting fellow for Middle East policy at the Brookings Institution, joins us. He was recently in Egypt observing the first round of the presidential elections, and we will discuss the explosive situation now developing as the remnants of the old regime brazenly try to turn back the clock. Then we will speak with a Syrian-American activist who is the spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees. Rafif Jujati joins us to discuss the extent of popular opposition to the Assad family as the regime desperately and ruthlessly tries to maintain its grip on power and how, in spite of deadly reprisals, more and more army soldiers are defecting to the Free Syrian Army. Then, following reports in the Washington Post that the U.S. is expanding a secret shadow war in Africa, we will examine the role of U.S. Special Forces in their hunt for the murderous warlord Joseph Kony and how the Rwandan government, an ally of the U.S., is destabilizing the east of the Congo. Maurice Carney, the Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, joins us along with Jacques Bahati, a policy analyst at the Africa Faith and Justice Network. Joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. He was recently in Egypt, where he was observing the first rounds of the Egyptian presidential elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you make of this what's being described as a coup by the Supreme Court in dissolving the parliament on the eve of a presidential election?
Well, it's something that's very troubling from the standpoint of a democratic standpoint, certainly, and even from a domestic stability standpoint. It's also very troubling because it adds kind of more uncertainty and more frustration. On the Egyptian street. So it is definitely a setback for Egyptians across the board.
So is it likely then to spark the kinds of protests we've seen going back to the original Tahrir Square? Because I believe that Mubarak is very close to death. And, of course, one of the candidates in the elections coming up over the weekend is his last prime minister and a former friend and Air Force general.
Right.
He's up against a Muslim Brotherhood candidate. There's a sense that what's really at the heart of this revolution is whether the revolutionaries will overcome what is referred to by the Arabic word, the remnants.
Yeah. Well, that's been the challenge all along. But the revolutionaries have been hampered by many things, including their own lack of organization, their own lack of leadership, their inability to work with others. They're quite a divided group, but that's true really across the board of the Egyptian political scene. The Muslim Brotherhood is probably equally, if not even, it's even harder for them to work with different groups. So one of the fundamental problems with this transition, at least from the standpoint of anti-regime forces, is that they've been extremely divided. And so it's one of the reasons why I think the timing of this of these latest developments suggests that the SCAF, the military rulers, are confident in the fact that we probably won't see the kinds of mass mobilization that we saw in Tahrir Square in January of last year. And that is because there is now so much water under the bridge. There's a lot of bad blood between these different groups on the ground and the various political forces. The Muslim Brotherhood has lost a tremendous amount of credibility, as have, frankly, other forces like the revolutionaries. So I think it's less likely that we'll see a mass mobilization like we saw 16 months ago. But obviously the situation can change. You know, we don't yet know what will happen with the presidential elections. We don't know what will happen on the economic front. There's a lot of troubling signs there as well. There's a security vacuum on the ground. There are a lot of very, very troubling trends that could push this in any number of directions. But the one thing that I think we can say with a fair amount of certainty is that we won't be seeing a stable democratic Egypt anytime soon.
So in this ruling that took place by the Supreme Court, along with it, its leader, who took it a lot further than people were expecting, in declaring last year's parliamentary vote unconstitutional, he also, in a separate ruling, decided that the former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik, who was running for president and was the last Prime Minister under the old Mubarak regime, he was instated and given a seal of approval by the court. So, given that these two rulings came down together, I fail to see how it could be, if the purpose of this is for the old guard to get their candidate Shafik elected by dissolving the parliament and really angering the Muslim Brotherhood, at the same time saying that this candidate that's essentially the ancient regime candidate who, under the political exclusion law passed by the parliament, the senior officials from the former President Hosni Mubarak regimes were banned from standing. So the court overturns that ruling. At the same time, don't you think it's likely to backfire? I mean, isn't it likely to make people want to vote for the Brotherhood?
It could backfire, certainly. And I think that's one of the things that the Muslim Brotherhood is counting on right now. There are a lot of voices calling on the Brotherhood to withdraw their candidate from the elections in a few days in protest. Because on the one hand, the Brotherhood is calling this a coup and saying that the elections are likely to be rigged. On the other hand, they're going full steam ahead with these elections. So they're, you know, thereby legitimizing them. So there's a double message coming out of the Brotherhood, and one of the demands by outside groups, revolutionary groups and liberals, is well, you know, you have to put your money where your mouth is. If this really is such a flawed and delegitimized process, then why are you lending it legitimacy? You need to withdraw from the race. And I think they're not willing to do that. And I think, you know, that is... It's a risky proposition, but they may feel that they're, you know, from the Brotherhood standpoint, there are the political forces on the ground and the revolutionary groups have turned against them. They're now in a confrontation with the military rulers, and things might get worse. They've lost their one foothold, which was the parliament. And things might get worse down the road. And so they probably see the presidency as the only chance that they have left to avoid, you know, something like a serious crackdown. So they're prepared, I suppose, to take that risk. But, you know, it's that kind of decision making that has been so troubling, really, for the rest of the political class in Egypt, in that the Brotherhood's priorities seem to be focused entirely on what is good for them as an organization, as opposed to what is the best way to achieve the goals of the revolution.
Again, I'm speaking with Khalid El-Gindi, a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he was recently in Egypt where he observed the first round of the Egyptian presidential elections, and we're discussing the ruling by the Egyptian Supreme Court that dissolved the parliament on the eve of the final round of presidential elections between a holdover from the Mubarak regime, Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik, Air Force General, who's running against Mr. Mursi, who's with the Muslim Brotherhood. There was a troubling development on Wednesday when the Justice Ministry announced that army personnel would have the right to detain civilians during the election. How do you interpret that?
Well, this is the old emergency law through the back door. Just a few weeks ago, Egyptians were celebrating the expiration of the emergency law, which had been in place for 3 decades. And it now looks clearly like that was a purely cosmetic move, and now they've just kind of brought it back through the back door. So this is standard procedure for the SCAF, for the military rulers of Egypt. They've been extremely heavy-handed with their political opponents and critics. They've tried thousands and thousands of young people before military tribunals. There's been, of course, the violent responses to protesters on the streets. Something like 100 protesters have been killed since Mubarak's departure by Egyptian security forces. And so a lot of their behavior is clearly anti-democratic. They have manipulated the political process at various stages. And so what we're seeing now really is, you know, it's hard to take any one development in isolation, because this is the culmination of 16 months of incompetence on the one hand, attempted manipulation of the political and legal process on the other, as well as bad decisions by all sides, including revolutionary groups and political parties. And so that's why we're at where we are today. The bulk of the responsibility lies with the SCAF as the managers of this transition, and who have consistently laid out a bad sequence and bad priorities and simply the wrong roadmap from the very beginning. But there's plenty of blame to go around. It's just that the lion's share of the blame goes with those who are running the show.
So, Khaled El-Gindi, the court ruled based upon in invalidating last year's parliamentary elections, because some of the seats were contested on a proportional basis and others on the first past the post, and that was the excuse, if you will. In the election, of course, the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Department party won 46% of the vote, and coming in second was the Salafist Al-Nur party that caught everybody by surprise. I spoke to a number of Egyptians during the time that you were there, they all said very emphatically that Al-Nur, and that basically what's been happening is that the Saudi Arabians have been pouring in tons and tons of money and essentially created the Salafists, and that was the big surprise. So when you say there's a backlash against the Brotherhood, is that backlash the realization amongst a lot of Egyptians, the extent to which the Saudi feudal regimes, if you will, are trying to influence this nascent democratic awakening in Egypt?
Well, I mean, I think definitely there's, because of Egypt's strategic position in the region and its close the close alliance of Mubarak with Saudi Arabia and other Arab Gulf states, clearly the Saudis had an interest in the outcome. They were very upset with the overthrow of Mubarak and with his trial afterwards, and they've not been shy about expressing their disapproval of the entire Egyptian revolution. And there are, of course, these reports about money coming in from the Gulf and elsewhere. I think it's we need to be clear on one thing. The Saudi relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood is very complex. It's not there's a history of mistrust there. So I'm not sure that there is anything to show that there is money coming in directly from Saudi Arabia to the Brotherhood, but certainly the Salafis, there is a lot of at least anecdotal evidence to suggest that that's the case. But this gets to sort of a deeper problem with the way this transition has been managed, in that it is a process with no rules. It's a game without any rules. So there are no real campaign finance laws, for example, in Egypt. There's a spending limit, which, of course, several candidates exceeded without any ramifications, but there are no disclosure requirements like we have in most Western democracies that require, a party or a candidate to show where they get their funding and how it's spent. And really, this has been the pattern all throughout this process of a game with no rules, and then the rules that are there are sort of made up as they go along. And they're made up by the most powerful groups, the SCAF, occasionally with the assistance of the Brotherhood or other political groups. And it is what has really destabilized the situation, because you've gone, you were supposed to undertake a democratic transition that would strengthen governing institutions and elected institutions, and what do you have? You have a judiciary that used to be considered the pride and joy of Egypt, that was considered relatively independent, and it's now been compromised and its reputation destroyed. You have the first freely elected parliament dissolved. You have a president, a presidential election that pits two of the two most divisive and hated candidates in Egypt against one another.
But how did they get elected then?
With no rule. I mean, no, but powers of the president are not even clear.
Yeah, but I don't. That's a contradiction, Khalid al-Gindi. How did the two most despised and unpopular candidates get elected?
Oh, well, because you had you had the several candidates
splitting the vote
first round, and so you had the so-called revolutionary candidates, about three of them, who took a big chunk, more than 40% in the middle of the electorate. But it was, the pro-reform or pro-democracy vote, I would call it, was split among two or three candidates. The other half of the electorate went for the old guard, either the regime itself in the person of Ahmed Shafiq, or the Muslim Brotherhood, which is really, of course, it's been around for eight decades. It is part of the old power structure, in a sense. So the problem was the splitting of this, pro-change vote. But it was clear on the ground, the partisans of these two individuals, the majority of Egyptians don't want either of them. I think that is
right.
That is the point. But because of the electoral system, in order to, since no one candidate took 50% plus one, they had to do it by a runoff.
Sure. And now it's down to the lesser of the two evils, which we're not entirely unfamiliar with here in the United States.
Yeah, but here in the United States, you have a system that doesn't allow third parties really to flourish to begin with.
Exactly. So. Well, just in closing, Khalid al-Gindi, basically what we have now is you have no constitution, which is very strange that you're having elections before there's a constitution.
Right.
You have no parliament. And you have an election between two unpopular and somewhat discredited presidential candidates.
Yeah, and a compromised judicial branch.
That's a recipe for trouble.
It is a recipe for trouble, because there is not even one institution that people can claim confidence in or can cling to as at least a foothold towards a democratic future. I mean, it's definitely true that these events have set us back 16 months, if not more.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Khalid al-Gindi.
Oh, you're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Khalid al-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. He was recently in Egypt, where he was observing the first round of the Egyptian presidential election. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a Syrian-American activist.
Then they fight you. Then you win. I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Boy, Azizi lit the hoof. and it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Han Yunus, the new moon shines.